Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review podcast. Our guest today is Volker M. Velter. I wanted to ask, it seems like Geddes has the sense that that science and religion can be harmoniously related, or a so-called merger of science and religion, and that there's that for setting up a city, the importance not only again of the kind of practical things, but also having something like a temple, like the Acropolis, and I was thinking, in these very ancient cities, certainly in Europe or in other ancient civilizations, you have these ancient cities which are centered around some sort of sacred place like that. Just thinking about Notre Dame in Paris, mm-hmm, and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I was curious, also hearing you talk about Tel Aviv, when it comes to a modern city or a new city, or certainly like most of our cities here in the United States, where that don't have that ancient history or pre-modern past, how exactly does that sense of spirituality or religion, if at all, connect with the kind of modern city?
Mm-hmm. I mean, for Geddes, this was absolutely essential. You cannot have a city which only consists of, let's say, urban neighborhoods, a shopping district,
right?
Maybe some industrial business park, office park, where you produce things. That, in Geddes' understanding, is not a city. That he calls a town. Right. And it only becomes a city when you have these certain nodes, for which I use in my work on Geddes, I use the expression cultural acropolis. Mm-hmm. And this term has to do with that the Acropolis in Athens, of course, sits physically above the city. So it sits on this rock, and that's where all the temples are. So it's physically, it's visible within the city. And that's what Geddes was always after. If you have these concentrations of certain cultural institutions, universities, art museums, scientific study centers, laboratories, then you have to concentrate them physically in one area, and you have to make them visible in the city. So, and the easiest, of course, is to put them on the highest point in the city. So in Edinburgh, this was very conveniently the entire old town, which also physically is the highest point in the already sort of a pretty lively topography of Edinburgh. And that's where the university was located in on that high part of the town. And that's where Geddes builds this apartment complex for professors, intellectuals, artists, and students. So to inject these kind of intellectual classes into the urban realm and to marry town and gown. In Tel Aviv, also these cultural institutions, they are sort of concentrated actually on the highest point within Tel Aviv, which is very, one has to understand this, very relative, because one doesn't really notice one is on the highest point, but it is actually sort of really on the physical highest territory. And so for Geddes, but you not only had to have these cultural institutions, but you also had sort of this temple-like building. And so, and he was not talking here about a church in a traditional sense, sort of like Scottish Presbyterianism, sort of that you have a kirk, like a high kirk. I mean, they were historically obviously in cities, and they were always important for Geddes, that these, historically speaking, these churches, cathedrals, they should never be torn down. They should be sort of reused, rebuilt, repaired, because they do express, historically speaking, where the spiritual forces become visible in the urban fabric. Now, at his own time, of course, I mean, Geddes does come out of a Scottish sort of religious tradition. He was very, very firm in his Bible readings. I mean, he could quote the Bible, and he knew the Bible in and out. And so when you read his letters with the early Zionists, he always quotes from the Bible and sort of says, I consider myself like this or that person in the Bible. He was very convinced that he had this sort of almost biblical task to sort of rebuild Eretz Israel and Jerusalem. But then he designs, essentially he comes up with modern day temple complexes. So if we stay with for example, with his work in Palestine for the Zionists, Geddes also got the commission to design the Hebrew University, which was this attempt of European and American Zionists to establish an institution of higher learning in early Palestine, and which was supposed to be located in Jerusalem. on Mount Scopus, and it actually exists on Mount Scopus today. It also has a second campus, which obviously has to do with that Jerusalem was for a long time not accessible from the state of Israel. And so for the Mount Scopus site, Geddes then designs a very interesting, very complex university master plan. But at the center of this master plan was a graduation hall, where you would have your graduation ceremonies at the end of the academic year. And this hall, I mean, his son-in-law, Sir Frank Mears, a Scottish architect, designed. And this building is full of symbolism. It's kind of built on a floor plan, which sort of is developed from the Star of David, and it's covered on the inside with Stars of David, but also with other symbols, and sort of recalling sciences. And so he sort of tried to really, and it's very carefully, the size of the dome is very carefully developed in relation to the Dome of the Rock. It, of course, had to be larger.
Yeah.
It's also larger than St. Peter's in Rome, and to make that clear, and it's also larger than Hagia Sophia in Constantinople or in Istanbul, to make it absolutely clear that, so to speak, the world religions, they have their place, but now we are sort of creating our domed building. Very interesting. I mean, this is so full of symbolism. And I mean, of course, none of this ever got built. And to the best of my knowledge, Geddes never had a chance to actually build one of these modern city temples.
Okay.
He always proposes them. If you look at his town planning work he does in British India, in many cities today in India or in Pakistan, he always designs somewhere this cultural complex. Sometimes it's an urban square, which maybe has the shape of a hexagon or an octagon, and that becomes the symbolic center. Sometimes it is a university. And even in 1923, if I remember correctly, I think it was 23. Geddes was in the United States, and Sir Frank Mears, for example, designs an outlook tower for an American city. So he actually translates this idea into a skyscraper with an outlook tower on top of the skyscraper. So where then the outlook tower, and there was a museum in this complex, where that then was supposed to become this kind of symbolic new spiritual temple center. So the spirituality, I don't think it was religious in any traditional sense,
right,
but it was really this kind of vitalist, Henry Bergson inspired life philosophy, Lebensphilosophy cast into stone. Mm-hmm. So this mixture of that, we have to basically re-spiritualize the hardcore sciences.
Right.
I mean, Geddes at some point studied or went into study biology, and there is this anecdote that he basically got out of his studies because he was asked to dissect or to work with a dissected body of some laboratory animal.
Uh-huh.
And for him, I mean, this was absolutely, you cannot study life by looking at a dead animal's body.
Right.
So, and this is where he sort of positioned himself. You have to study the animal, obviously, or the organism in its environmental setting.
Right.
And that's where he had a famous formula, which was sort of function, organism, environment, so how these things are related to each other. And that's where this notion of the temple comes from. Okay. There's a really interesting, I mean, this, when you look at the Geddesian temple schemes, I mean, they're fantastic architectural drawings, and they are sort of full of this symbolism, and at the same time, one also has sort of a strong sense that, of course, they are only symbols and they only work as a quasi-religious sites for those who are already initiated into the cult, if you want. Otherwise, you don't understand. I mean, it's just like entering a temple or a sacred building of a distinct religion. If you don't know something about this religion, you may admire the craftsmanship of certain mosaic works, but the symbolic meaning will never really become clear to you. You may have an inkling that this is an important space,
right.
but one doesn't really understand this. And so So in many of these Gedesian temple schemes, I mean, they were like really fanciful drawings or utopian visions. But the scheme in itself does have really interesting influence on modern 20th century town planning when we come to the period of the mid 20th century.
Yeah.
Sort of at the end of the Second World War and the collapse, obviously, of the big dictatorships or some of the big dictatorships in Europe. Stalinism, of course, was not collapsing, so but the National Socialist or the fascist dictatorships. And yeah. I mean, that did also raise for many people the question sort of what is the value of modernity, of modernism, of modern life, because yeah. they were all implicated in these dictatorships.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we have this turn towards a new humanism at the end of the Second World War in the late 1940s, early 1950s. And the CIAM, the Congress Internationaux d'Architecture Moderne, this pressure group which was founded in the late 1920s and had regular conferences, like the 1933 conference from which the Charter of Athens right. Was emerged, this big town planning document which sort of said that cities should have sort of the residential zones, the working zones, the yeah. recreational zones, and then these communication lines which connect these three zones and allow the citizens to move around. And there was an equivalent CM8 conference which was called under the theme of the heart of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And the heart of the city, that was sort of an attempt by many architects. If you look at the proceedings of the CM conference, it's all about public spaces in cities and how can you create meaningful public spaces? How can you furnish these public spaces with cultural institutions, with museums, with educational institutions?
Yeah.
And you suddenly realize this really is an echo of the Gedesian idea of having a cultural acropolis in the city.
Okay.
And there's actually, there's a biographical lab. There is a Jacqueline Turwitt who was a British town planner, and she was a student of Geddes. I mean, she never met with Geddes, but she was a follower, a very serious student of Geddes.
Yeah.
And she was also the secretary to CM. She was the translator of books into English by Siegfried Gideon. She was a real key figure in transmitting this Gedesian thinking
yeah.
into the mid-century debate about among modernist architects and town planners.
Okay.
And so I think the Geddes, I think, in the end, one could sort of say he was actually, even though he was always on the outside of modern town planning,
yeah.
sort of in the immediate post-war period, I think he was actually right at the heart of it.
Okay.
A very, very interesting sort of trajectory, how his ideas come back.
Yeah.
I mean, it also ties, of course, into the city crown idea, which Bruno Taut had in Germany.
Okay.
So Geddes was not sort of entirely unique in this thinking.
Right, right.
That was the crucial part for his approach to town planning. And that, of okay. course, again, I think sets him against certain other people who
right.
sort of think, what is this gentleman talking about? I mean,
yeah.
although, even though Le Corbusier, I mean, if you read very carefully his writings, you always find that even somebody like Le Corbusier was looking for a certain spiritual dimension.
Right, right, right.
For his work, for his life.
Yeah.
But I think Geddes was just, very sort of convinced that that's actually the key. And he
yeah.
basically, if you look at his Indian town planning works, he often suggests all you have to do is like an incubator almost. You have to put these cultural institutions into a city.
Yeah.
And then from there, into a town, and from there, eventually the city will emerge.
Right. Amazing. It's been very interesting to read some of your published writing on different figures and see some of the connections among them. For instance, kind of the question, how questions of psychology and the environment relate to building. And so I wanted to next ask you about your research on Ernst Freud, the architect who was the son of Sigmund Freud and the father of Lucian Freud. And I think the title of your book, The Case of the Modern Bourgeois Home, there's this implication of a kind of paradox or tension in that the relationship between modernism and the bourgeois has some tensions in it. And I guess Freud, as an architect, was I guess in some way embodied that tension or explored it. So could you tell us about kind of what is the relation between modernism and the bourgeois for Ernst Freud?
Yeah, I mean, Ernst Freud, yeah, that was a real, real labor of love project. There's no other way to describe this, because it actually goes back to the 1990s when I was still living in then West Berlin in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And I was working as a historian, architectural historian. I was as a student of architecture at that time, in a private, for a private architectural office in West Berlin, which was working in restoration and assessing the structural integrity of buildings, which were supposed to be listed as monuments. So sort of the equivalent in America would be a building which goes into the National Register of Historic Monuments. And one of the buildings we were looking at was a country house outside of Berlin, the Frank country house, which was a big, huge private villa country house at Lake Schwilo, fantastic, overlooking the lakeside. And we did an initial assessment of this building, and my task in these assessments always was sort of to figure out what was the historical importance of the buildings, who was the architect, where are historical sources like images and so on. And this building was interesting because for a long time nobody knew who was the architect, especially during the building was from at the end of the Second World War until the early 90s, it was within East Germany, and then it became accessible, easier accessible, obviously, with the collapse of East Germany and with the wall finally being taken down. And eventually one journalist, Lily von Thurn und Taxis, she then figured out in the early 1990s, she was writing for a West Berlin daily newspaper, she figured out that the architect was Ernst Freud, a son of Sigmund Freud. And ever since I was involved with this project, I kept literally a box where I was collecting information about Ernst Freud. So whenever something came up, I just copied it and it went into this box. And eventually, I was always fascinated by this. I always thought this is really interesting that Freud had an architect son. Because it was interested, and I was interested in this because I had never heard about this architect. Because when you grow up in Germany and you go into studying architecture and then you study in, or you studied in West Berlin, I mean, you learn so much about Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, Walter Gropius, and the Bauhaus, and all these names were, I mean, they were always around us. The buildings were in Berlin around us. We could go to look at the social housing complexes, but this Freud, this was never there. And I was always really interested in architectural history, and that always captivated me. And so for a long time, I just collected Freud, and then once I finished my doctorate, and then I decided I finally want to do something with this Freud material. The big question was what actually to do with this Freud material, because whenever I spoke to people about Freud, then of course, oh yeah, this is Sigmund Freud, this is psychoanalysis, and this is, you have to sort of look at it from that point of view, but I'm not a psychoanalyst. To be quite honest, I'm also not entirely convinced that I'm actually really deeply interested in psychoanalysis, and for all sorts of reasons. But I also always thought that it is not right. It always felt not right to me. And initially, I don't think there was a different vocabulary available to me. I always thought it's not right to sort of analyze or to look at the son simply in the light of what the father has done. I always sort of thought, with all respect to my own father, I always sort of thought, this is not right. One doesn't do something like this. And eventually, and this is where the subtitle comes from, the case study of the modern bourgeois home. Eventually, I mean, I had a long list of projects Freud had worked on. Once I had moved to the United Kingdom, I obviously also then could look at the archive of Ernst Freud, which is preserved with the Royal Institute of British Architects in London, because Freud lived from late 1933 onwards. He left Berlin, he fled Berlin and moved with his three sons and his wife to London. And so his private office papers, they ended up at the RIBA. And so I had a chance to look at the RIBA archival collection. And at that point, I realized that Freud never, ever participated in everything which stands in architectural history, or apparently stands in architectural history, for Weimar Republic Germany.
Right, right.
Social housing estates, no Freud contribution.
Yeah.
Schools, hospitals, all these socially initiated projects, Freud is never there.
Yeah.
Instead, he designs country houses, large private villas. He designs extremely comprehensive interiors for these lavish bourgeois apartments in Berlin.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, these apartments, they had maybe 20 rooms or something. They were yeah. sort of on an entire floor of an apartment building, and you yeah. can get these Freud designs for 40, 50, 60 pieces of furniture. I mean, he designs the tables, the couches, the bookshelves, and the liquor trolleys, where you can sort of wheel a trolley with liquor bottles in it on caster wheels, and yeah. everything is designed. So he's really, and this took me a while to realize, that he's actually really working for the bourgeoisie, for the yeah. upper middle classes, the middle classes, primarily the Jewish middle classes in Berlin, upper middle classes, but not entirely. There were also clients which were clearly not of Jewish background. And that's where then this project became really interesting for me, because I thought, this gives me actually access to look at Freud and sort of answering the question, why is he not appearing in the history of German modernist architecture?
Yeah.
And to cut through this in a nutshell, the argument I'm putting forward is that Freud is essentially written out of the history because his work doesn't fit into the standard historiography of
right.
this period.
Because
right. in retrospect, we are obviously looking at Weimar Republic Germany in hindsight, with the knowledge that onto the Weimar Republic was followed by National Socialism and the Holocaust in the larger German history. And so we are looking always sort of at the Weimar Republic, sort of how could this happen? How could all this sort of these wonderful initiatives for social housings and modernizing German society, democracy in Germany, how could all this sort of in a funnel sort of end up in National Socialism?
Yeah, yeah.
And so the history of the Weimar Republic, in a sort of expressed in simple terms, is basically considered, I mean, either you were with the socialists or the communists, Luxembourg, Liebknecht,
right.
and those forces, with the people who were sort of critically about this on
yeah.
the political left, or you were sort of working with the reactionary forces, with the traditionalists. And you know that this wonderful argument, which they at some point had in 1920s in German architecture, sort of the pitched roof
right,
against the flat roof,
yeah.
das Flachdach gegen das Steildach, and it was
yeah.
literally interpreted that the pitched roof is an expression of a reactionary mindset,
right,
whereas
right.
the flat roof, simply because it's flat and unusual, it is apparently a sign of your progressive attitude.
Right, right.
And what I realized then, reading a lot about Weimar Republic architecture, and also reading source books from that time, publications from the period, always hoping I can find something about Freud,
yeah,
I realized that there is a whole discussion at that time about bourgeois housing and Mittelklassen Wohnungen, and how do the upper bourgeoisie, how are they, the upper middle classes, how can they live?
Yeah.
And this was an absolute eye-opener for me, because when I was a student in Berlin, I had never heard about this.
Yeah.
Pages over pages, books over books, how to actually create floor plans for these large houses, for the industrialists who built themselves country houses. And so that's where the project then took shape, and so I was saying, okay, I'm going to, obviously, I want to discuss where Freud came from and what was sort of what figure he was, but not a biography, but sort of saying, look, here we have this architect who was entirely sort of living this middle class, upper middle class life. He was working for these people, creating their worlds.
Yeah.
And that obviously came all to an end, a very sudden end, because he and many of his clients, they had to flee for their lives after 1933. And there is, so to speak, and I was what I called on a conference I went to a few months ago at the Quarto Institute in London. I said, there is a second exile of Freud. And the second exile is that after 45, he was never basically being written back into the history, because this whole bourgeois discussion about bourgeois housing and so on, that simply was non-existent. And this is very interesting. When you begin looking like this, you suddenly realize that the architectural history of the Weimar Republic actually is not a simple juxtaposition of left versus right, flat roof versus pitched roof. Progressives, communists, socialists versus national socialists and so on the other side. And that obviously exists, this juxtaposition, but there is sort of this third pole, and this sort of, it's actually more like a triangular relationship. There is the philosopher Helmut Plesner, who wrote this interesting book in 1924, a critique of social radicalism, the limits of community, a critique of social radicalism, where he basically puts forward an argument saying that Germany, in Weimar Republic Germany, doesn't need more socialism, doesn't need more community ideas of the blood, as he calls the community's ideas on the right, political right. But he says what we need is this bourgeois society. And that's where Freud obviously comes in. And for architectural history, when you begin looking at projects and designs, it becomes really interesting. Take, for example, the Tugendhat Villa by Mies van der Rohe. This wonderful, wonderful house in Brünn in the Czech Republic. And this building with the one of the earliest lavish open floor plans on the living room level, and these big glass sheets which can be lowered down and you can open it up into the house, into the surroundings. And when we talk about that building, it used to be so that one suddenly begins talking about sort of abstract concepts of space. And when we talk about the social housing estates at the same time, we're talking about minimum existence. How many square footage can we have? But what for a long time was never really discussed is, what is the social background of the Tugendhat House? And I mean, they were very wealthy entrepreneurs, industrial business people. And they built themselves this wonderful, lavish house. And I always thought sort of, I mean, one thinks, well, we should discuss this. I mean, nowadays it is discussed because things have changed. But one should discuss these large country houses, not only as in suddenly we're shifting the category. We're no longer talking existence minimum. We are suddenly talking abstract categories of space. Let's talk about that. This is a house for a wealthy family. And then when you start looking at the photographs, the floor plans, the images, then you suddenly realize actually that all the bourgeois elements are in the house. So if you look at early black and white photographs, when you entered the Tugendhat house, there was a small foyer space before then the stair goes down into the lower level because the house is built on a slope. So you enter on the upper level and you walk down into this fantastic living open plan living room area, for which the house is really famous for. But on the upper level, once you're through that actual door inside the house, you're looking at a beautiful paneled wall of, I think it's Makassar ebony, very, very beautiful wood paneling, very expensive, very sort of an immediate expression of the wealth. Then in front of this panel, you have sort of two chairs, tubular steel chairs, and a small table. And on the table, you often see in photographs, there's like a little bowl. Which maybe it was like an ashtray, but I think it was actually a bowl, for example, where you put down your visitor's card. So you can find these rituals, the social rituals of how certain classes sort of initiated. You go to, you drop off your visitor's card, the maid takes the card to the lady of the house, and then the lady reads your name, and then either you are admitted or you, the maid comes back and that either the lady of the house isn't in or that she is a sort of under migraine or whatever. So there are these rituals in which social contacts are initiated, and you can suddenly see that all this exists in these modernist houses. And so this book about Freud, I mean, that really then turned into, on the one hand, a study of his domestic architectural works, simply, I mean, as a documentary, what did he do, whom did he design for? And also it then turned into this larger project, actually sort of recovering, saying, look, there is a part in the Weimar Republic Germany that they may not have succeeded, they may not have sort of be successful with establishing a middle class or an upper middle class society. I think historians could say much more about this. Yeah. But if we want to have a real sort of a comprehensive history of this period, then I think we cannot simply in hindsight sort of only looking at two forces where we know the one force we don't want to be associated with.
Right.
And therefore we sort of position ourselves in hindsight on the supposedly right side of history.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's a sort of is really a really bizarre concept of writing history. And I think then one has to say, okay, we have the traditionalists, we have the reactionaries, we have the socialists with all their social programs manifesting in architecture. And we also have the middle classes, the bourgeoisie, sort of making their point.
Yeah.
And in the 1920s and 1930s, before 33, if there is lots of literature you can find where contemporary writers about architecture, they precisely knew this. Yeah. I mean, there is one gentleman, I think his name is Sigrist Albert. He wrote a book about das Neue Bauen in the early 1930s. And somewhere in this book, he actually sort of says that the Neues Bauen, this modernist architecture, has two faces. It is socialist and it's high capitalist. So at that point, there was an absolute awareness that the architecture in itself does not convey a political message. But that the architecture is used by sort of different players within the field of politics.
Right.
And that awareness, I think, has basically disappeared or for a long time was not available. Right. And essentially architecture was simply read as if it's cubic, white and social housing, it is the good kind of architecture. Right. And if it's the other architecture, then it is sort of, it's always measured against this ideal of the Bauhaus.
Yeah.
Sort of how far is it close or away from the Bauhaus? And that's where I think Freud became really interesting. I mean, the last other point, very interesting of Freud, of course, is that during this work, I then also discovered that Ernst Freud actually designed for all the psychoanalysts, the first generation of psychoanalysts who had trained in Vienna with his father and but then lived in Berlin and worked in Berlin, that Ernst Freud had actually designed for almost all of them the psychoanalytical consulting rooms, including the couches.
Okay.
So there is this one chapter in the book which doesn't immediately deal with domestic or architecture in itself, but with this very interesting sort of early history of psychoanalytical consulting rooms.
Wow.
And how Ernst Freud actually sort of challenges the way his father positioned the couch in the room. And Ernst Freud also cleared out all these statues and anything. So they become actually modern interiors, anything which kind of collects dust, which one could claim is an ornament, like the Oriental rug, which Sigmund Freud had on his couch. All that doesn't really exist in Ernst Freud's consulting rooms.
Amazing.
So that was a real, very interesting, tiny little segue, which the Freud project took on.
This is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and our guest today is Volker M. Welter. When we come back, we'll talk more about modern architecture and urbanism. Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review podcast. Our guest today is Volker M. Welter.